I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Novelist and short story author Lily King has written 7 books. Her 2014 novel, Euphoria, won the Kirkus Prize for Fiction, and she may be best known for her 2020 release, Writers and Lovers. Her new novel, Heart the Lover, is a love story spanning multiple decades and follows a nameless narrator and her intense romance with her college sweetheart. The book dives into questions about identity, crafting fiction, and various forms of grief. Cover your ears if you want to avoid spoilers, but it has a surprising connection to her novel, Writers and Lovers. I recently spoke with Lily King about Heart the Lover, and here's our conversation. So could you give our listeners a description of Heart the Lover?
Sure. I like to say that it all begins when a college senior goes on a bad date with a smart guy, and it sets off the actions that unfold over the course of the next 30 years for her. And it is a big fat love story about your first love that you did not marry, and exactly what happens to all that love when it transforms into something else, but you keep that person close.
So this book has a connection to one of your previous novels, but it can be read as a standalone. And I'm not sure if you want to talk about that specific connection or if you want to leave the pleasure of discovering it, you know, to the reader. So maybe instead we can just talk about what it's like to revisit some of your characters.
Well, it was entirely unexpected. And so I very much always thought of this as a standalone book, because I didn't anticipate the connection to Writers and Lovers when I started it. And even as I wrote the whole thing, I was uncertain about whether I was really, you know, the first draft, I just was uncertain about whether I was going to stick with it or not. And it was just sort of an experiment. And then it really started to be the real thing, and it very much surprised me. So I don't want to reveal too much, but it was very obviously very natural. I mean, I didn't expect it, but what happened was I was taking a note, I don't know, probably 20, 30 pages in, and I was taking a note in the back of my notebook where I write and I keep notes. And I wrote the name of the main character's husband, and I was like, what? She's married to him? And that's how it kind of started.
We do not know our narrator's name for quite a while, but we do know what she is called by those around her. Daisy, Jordan, Hink. And I know why her name wasn't revealed to the reader, but talk to me about the importance or power of a name. Perhaps, you know, the fact that we don't know her name, what power is that? But also, the names that others give to her, do they have an effect on the character?
Always an interesting experience to be given a different name. And there are certain people who just nickname you. And then you have this new nickname, and it does give you a little bit of power, sort of a power to reinvent yourself a little bit, or this idea that you're somehow a little different than you were before you had this nickname. Again, not something that I intended. I don't think of a character's name when I start out necessarily. And often I struggle. If I'm writing a first person narrative, I don't need a name until someone actually uses their name. And that can take a very long time. And with this book, I didn't even think about her name. I didn't even think about what her real name was in that first scene, or it's not the first scene of the book, but an early scene where she gets renamed Jordan. It didn't really occur to me that we don't actually know her real name. And I think it often doesn't occur to the reader. So that the reader, when they do find out her real name, they are very surprised, because they didn't really understand that they didn't ever know her name. It's a little bit of a trick. It's not something I intended, but it sort of tricked my editor, and she liked that, and she wanted to keep that alive.
So the book is broken up into 3 sections, 3 different times in the narrator's life. You imagine her in her early 20s and then again in her 40s. And in part three, we learn that the narrator's son is experiencing some health concerns. You know, up until this point, we had seen the narrator as a student, as a writer. And then in this third part, we're really able to see her as a mother. What did you want to explore through her various roles?
I'm just fascinated with the passage of time in fiction and in life, and how you have this opportunity not just to show someone in one moment in their life, but many moments. And you can dip in. I mean, there's that middle section where she's in her 40s, and you're just dipping in for about 20 pages, and then you're dipping out, but you just get a little sense of what's happened. And everybody grows, and everybody learns something and develops new strengths, and you become a mother and you are transformed. It's just the nature of motherhood. And I'm so interested in that and that kind of love. You know, the first part is this really fierce, intense infatuation that turns into a big, big romance and a deep love. And then, you know, you get to jump and see what happened to that. And also these new kinds of love that have come into her life and that she's capable of. And I was just interested in exploring kind of the human heart and everything that it is capable of holding.
You know, I mentioned we meet this narrator at three different times in her life. Did you always know there'd be three parts to this book?
Well, when I started the book, I knew that there would be what is now part three. And that's really what I thought would be the huge meat of the book, and that I would just write this little college scene, you know, to kind of have a little backstory. And then it really expanded and expanded. And so now it's kind of half the book. And then I took the great leap into what is now part three. But part three always gave me such trouble. And I would write a draft, read it over, and I'm like, okay, part three needs to be more tension there. It needs to be tighter. Why is she there? Why isn't she back home where she should be? And I kept on increasing the tension. I kept on increasing, kind of condensing the time frame for the thing that she needs to get back to. And I just never could make it work. And I finally had 11 days before I had to hand in the final draft. And I collapsed on the couch. Said to my husband, I cannot get rid of the flatness. I don't know why I can't make this work. And he said what he'd been saying for a year, which was, she needs to go there with a secret. And I was always like, there is no secret. She has no secret. There's no secret. Stop saying that. But this time, with 11 days to go, I was like, okay. And I kind of wanted to prove him wrong. So I came into my study and I opened up the last page of part one, and I wrote five lines when she is in Brooklyn seeing her friend, and I changed it, and the secret was born, quote unquote. And then I had to change the entire rest of the novel in 11 days. So I had to create part two. Part two existed at the beginning as a playground scene, 3.5 pages. And I had to write all of that, and then I had to utterly change part three to increase the tension, which thankfully I think it very much worked, but it was terrible. And I was exhilarating and I was terrified, and I had no idea if my editor and my agent would even go for this, but I just did it. And I wrote all day and all night, and it was so fun. And fortunately they loved it. And it's like the whole book was just waiting for that all along. And it just took me until the very, very, very last minute to figure it out.
I think you did a beautiful job of capturing this idea that you can love someone in your present life, but also hold on to love for someone from your past. And like, your narrator's husband is never jealous or insecure about the marriage, and it felt very healthy. Was this intended, or was it just an unexpected piece of the puzzle?
Well, I knew it would be part of the puzzle. I mean, I have to say, I very much draw on my own marriage for that marriage. And I do feel that I've experienced some sort of miracle in my life that I landed into what I feel is a very, very healthy and beautiful marriage. And I come from a long line of divorce. Even my grandparents were divorced, and I never saw a healthy marriage for decades. And so I do like to celebrate that. I did like to show that that's a possibility. And I feel like Jordan, in her college years, she's a little feral emotionally. She's a little insecure and incapable of really saying how she feels. And I just wanted to show that even if you are someone like that, you can grow and you can learn how to be in a very fully functioning relationship.
There's not exactly a miscommunication issue, but two of your characters interpret the last days of their romance very differently. And I guess this just goes to show that there are two sides to every story, right or wrong. Can you talk about this idea for a little bit about perspective and lens and
Yes, I think that obviously there are always two sides to every story. There's usually many more sides depending on how many people were involved in the story because we are all having this very unique set of experiences and associations and memories all the time. And so when we approach something, it's impossible to have the same perspective. And in this case, it was just an entirely different perspective, and they weren't communicating properly. And there was just a lot of guesswork on either side. And I think when you're experiencing rejection or something that feels very powerfully negative from somebody else, it is impossible for you at that moment to imagine that something else is happening, that the other person is having an entirely different set of suppositions and emotions. I do think that's really important. I'm somebody who will just like boom, shut down, and I will interpret something one way, and I will just put up a wall. I'm much better about that now, but certainly when I was younger, I came from a difficult relationship with my father, and I sort of applied all of my techniques on people who didn't deserve it. And I think it's really important to ask questions and not shut down and be open to another perspective. So I think I wanted to capture a moment of that has huge consequences.
the narrator in this novel initially is a creative writing student and then a published author. Some of my favorite parts were listening in on discussions about literature and theory and thought. And one quote I noted is from our narrator: "All of literature rests on the promise that we change, we grow, have epiphanies, become better, understand our flaws." Do you agree?
I do think all of literature is based on that, or a lot of it. I mean, I do think there is sort of a ultimately hopeful nature to literature, and maybe even an encouragement. I mean, even when literature is depicting things that are, kind of the worst of us, the most basest actions, there's something for me hopeful about depicting that because, if we can absorb that and absorb the horror of it, perhaps we'll be less inclined to go that direction. It's identified. It's in black and white, and I think that is a hopeful act in itself. They have this argument that humans as a species are not evolving. They're not getting better. And that is a big argument. And unfortunately, am not as Pollyanna as Jordan is when they have that argument.
Another one was when the narrator began to understand the power of fiction and the reason we make things up. The narrator explains that her best story is about her father, but what was in the story didn't actually happen. She says, "These scenes that didn't happen concentrate and distill the emotion of what did." Can you talk about this power of fiction?
It's taken me a long time to understand that and to know that that is what is happening. But I do think it has always been sort of an impulse and an instinct of mine to sort of take sort of these raw emotions that I have felt and put them into a different package. And part of it is just the simple fact that when I write directly from experience, it feels flat to me. And when I infuse it with a fictional element, it feels so much more alive. And I feel somehow that I can reach higher ground and I can get to some of the most intense feelings better. And I don't know what a therapist would say about that, but it works for me. And I don't exactly know why, except that maybe it allows me a little more perspective and maybe a little more freedom, certainly. I guess maybe it's less scary to write that, and it's less devastating somehow to write a fictional scene, even though the end result is hopefully as devastating or intense as the original emotion that I had.
A couple of your characters argue or discuss where the genius lies in books, the structure, the images, the dialogue. I know how your characters feel, but do you have an argument?
I think it's in the extraordinary combination of all those things. I think for me, it's that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's everything all together that makes the genius. And that every little element is working so perfectly with every other one that there is the genius. But I don't know.
There's a poignant scene at the end where I felt you really captured grief, but also the complicated and bittersweet moments surrounding loss. Did writing these scenes wreck you as much as it wrecked me reading them?
Oh, thank you. Writing the first draft, for sure, was extremely intense for me. And I walked around with a real heaviness of heart, just that weight, you know, inside. And I recognize it because I've written stuff like that before that's made me feel that way. And I knew that I just had to withstand it and keep going. It did not create the kind of crying that people have told me about, because it wasn't a surprise to me. You know, I went in there and I knew what had to be done. And so it was more that weighty grief rather than a good cry that makes you feel better.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
Oh, I hope that they feel their own capacity for love, really, and for all the different kinds of love we all feel. I just think right now, in particular, it is really a moment for us all to remember to stay human and to stay open and to remember how connected we are, how much we all have in common, and how much we all are capable of deep love for each other.
Well, the book is Heart the Lover. Lily King, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth.
Heart the Lover by Lily King was published by Grove Press. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new novel that tells the story of a modern-day giant. But this one is no fairy tale.
Author Ron Rindo's new novel opens with a harrowing scene, the dramatic and extraordinary birth of main character Gabriel Fisher. Gabriel weighs 18 pounds and measures 27 inches, and his unmarried mother, Rachel, dies after giving birth to him. He winds up living with his older brother, Jasper, but ultimately he's raised and cared for by several residents of their rural town, Lakota, Wisconsin. Life and Death and Giants takes its title from an Emily Dickinson poem quoted in the epigraph. Dickinson suggests that even monumental forces are insignificant in the vast machinery of the universe, and that life is fragile and fleeting. Rindo, who taught English and creative writing at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, explores those themes to wonderful effect in this sweeping epic that offers a bizarre mishmash of Amish culture, football, and, believe it or not, professional wrestling. The novel centers on Gabriel, a modern-day giant, but it's told through the perspectives of various townspeople. Even as a young child, Gabriel is something special, a gentle soul who is able to calm and communicate with animals. He also possesses extraordinary athletic talent, hitting so many home runs that he quickly advances out of his T-ball league. He grows into a hulking figure, nearly 9 feet tall, and able to throw bales of hay as if they were feathers. And his reputation grows along with him. Throughout his childhood and adolescence, his devout Amish grandparents try to hide him away from the modern world, but he's a force that truly can't be contained. Rindo's novel is marvelously constructed, with various perspectives offering a panoramic view of Gabriel's existence. And yet we never hear from Gabriel himself, which only adds to the mythological tone. But this is no fairy tale. Life and Death and Giants deals with weighty, real-life stuff. Family, faith, buried secrets, the price of fame, human kindness, and human weakness. The audio version of Life and Death and Giants is especially captivating, with a cast of talented narrators voicing each of the points of view. Fans of John Irving will appreciate the quirky characters and surprising plotline. And Rindo's remarkable ending will leave you thinking about everyday miracles. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Life and Death and Giants by Ron Rindo was published by St. Martin's Press. Joining us now is Lynn Graham of Watermark Books and Cafe in Wichita, Kansas. She's here to share her thoughts on some books with us, new releases, forthcoming titles, or books she just can't stop thinking about. Welcome to Marginalia, Lynn.
Thank you, Beth. I'm so excited to be here.
What do you have on your stack for us today?
Okay. I have quite a few, so you can cut me off at any point.
Okay.
But I think the one we are most excited about at Watermark has been Discontent by Beatrice Serrano. This is, I think, kind of a surprising, like, breakout novel of the year. I've seen a lot of people talking about it. It's translated from Spanish. Beatrice is from Spain. And I think it really taps into that feeling we all have of having to work to live, just kind of the discontent of that. It's less about the particular job and more about just the mundanity of having to work. And that's what this novel is really about, this woman who works in advertising who can't stand it, but it's just about the work she can't do. She's on anti-anxiety medications every Sunday just to get up in the morning on Monday and go in. She farms out work to design students online, you know, to then bring to her bosses as projects for herself. And yet, surprisingly, it ends on a hopeful note that there are ways through, is what I'm going to say.
What else do you have for us?
One I'm looking forward to coming up is a dark fantasy by Hyren Ennis. They wrote Leech, and it's very gritty. It's very immersive. I think it borders that line of fantasy and horror because it is about bugs a little bit, which okay. I didn't think I would enjoy. but it's set in this fantasy world, and we're following these exterminators because the bugs are monsters in this world. It's not just tiny little roaches. These are giant world, potentially world-ending creatures. So being an exterminator is a little more intense than what we would think. And I went into it not knowing what to expect, but the writing, first of all, is so beautiful, so detailed. It's just the right kind of purple prose to really get you into the world. And then somehow it keeps expanding into this broader political intrigue that spans decades. And by the end of it, I had decided I'd read a perfect book. It was kind of incredible. That's one I think could appeal to more people than they think, because I definitely didn't think it would appeal to me, but I absolutely loved it. If you want kind of an epic story, and if you want something new, I think that's the thing I enjoyed the most. I haven't read a book like this before, and I read a lot of books, so I'm always looking for something a little new. So loved that.
Okay. What is purple prose?
Ooh, purple prose is, I describe it as overly descriptive, kind of pretentious, like you kind of go, did they just throw a thesaurus at this book? And it can be done well and it can be done poorly. And I think this book does it in the best possible way, where instead of, sometimes it can be distracting. And you, again, it takes you out because you're like, do I have to go look up every other word to understand what's going on? Whereas in this world, the world is very rich. The world is very like sumptuous. And so the descriptive writing really gets you into the world from the first sentence.
Okay, very cool. What else do you have for us?
Okay, one that I believe you did an interview for was Seduction Theory by Emily Adrian.
Yeah.
Not enough people are talking about this book.
I agree.
Loved this book. I thought it was so good. I read this months ago and have not stopped thinking about it. It's, again, such a different writing style. I loved the way it's told. I don't think it's a spoiler to say it's basically being told through a master's thesis.
No, I think we learned that from like the beginning of the book.
Yeah, and yeah. I just loved that. And because of who is the one telling us, I don't always love an unreliable narrator, but in this case, this is just a drama book, okay? You're just here because you don't know who to trust. You don't know who to side for. Do you side with anyone? Do you dislike every character? Maybe. And I loved it, and I loved that we didn't know who was telling us the truth. And I loved the twist at the end where we get a little more of that. Like, do they trust themselves? I thought it was great.
Yeah, especially if you like those campus novels.
Yes, it's a great academia novel that's not quite dark academia, but a little bit.
That's right. Very good. Anything else?
I feel like we have to talk about The Hounding by Zenobi Purvis. This is another one that I think has kind of taken the book world by storm. It's backordered. We cannot keep it in stock, which is a bummer because I keep wanting to recommend it to people because it's one of the most, again, unique books I've ever read in that it's not a unique story. It's a story about these five sisters who live in this tiny, tiny English village in like the late 1700s. And it's a little bit of a witch hunt, right? But we never see from the perspective of the sisters. We're being told it from the perspective of the villagers and how everyone sees them differently. And I loved that it made you feel like you were the one also looking in on this situation. And are you to blame? Are the villagers to blame? Are the girls to blame? I loved it. And the symbolism in this book is rampant in a good way, I think. So that was one that I'm recommending. If you can get a hold of it, absolutely you should.
Well, you've given us a lot of books to think about. Lynn Graham with Watermark Books, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll include a list of Lynn's book recommendations at kmuw.org. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, Suzanne Perez, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goldlay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.